Efker, have you got a favourite spin-off TV show or film or...
This is very embarrassing. I have to, like, admit that it's Frasier or something like that. Frasier isn't cool in 2024, yeah. You know. But yeah, no, I thought Frasier was funny when I was younger. I still think some episodes of Frasier are very funny.
What about the new Frasier?
Wow, let's not... Let's okay. not go all there.
Right. All right.
Do you have some favorite spin-offs? It's going to be weird British shows that I've never heard of, isn't it?
Do I have a I hadn't really thought about this honestly, because the question I'm asking is because it leads into one of the games that we are discussing today. Maybe Mrs. Columbo. I quite like that.
Well, with Janeway.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Kate Mulgrew is her actual name, not Janeway.
Or Mrs. Columbo.
Yeah. But that's kind of cool, the fact that she played, like, those weird saying Mrs. Columbo, because it sounds like Bic for women, you know?
Well, no, because his name was Mr. Columbo.
Yeah, no, I understand how it... Yeah.
It's Mrs. Columbo.
Mr. Pac-Man.
Mr. Pac-Man. Ms. Mrs. Pac-Man. Pac-Man.
Uh-huh. Miss, yeah, indeed.
And you know it's Ms. Pac-Man because she has a pink bow.
Yeah,
you
know? Right? But he was never Mr. Pac-Man. He was just Pac-Man.
Oh, can we start calling him Mr. Pac-Man and Mr. Columbo?
I think we should. Mm. Yeah.
Welcome to Talk Cardboard, a podcast about board games and everything adjacent with me, Elaine, and you.
Me, Efka.
On today's episode, we will be talking a lot about our first impressions of Agamonia and also the game that I was referring to in the cold open, Terra Nova. By the way, it's not me that called it a spin-off.
Is that official?
Yeah, that's official. It was Helga Ostertag that said it's a spin-off.
Okay.
So it's
but
not
Helga
my fault.
Ostertag didn't design it.
No, but he designed Terra Mystica.
Well, yeah.
So...
Mm. I see.
He has a right to say this
well,
is a
no,
spin-off.
Well, no, of course, yeah, okay. It's the official spin-off stamp.
Just before we get into our first game, Agamonia, I want to give you a little disclaimer that there may be discussion here of brief references to enslavement in a fantasy setting. Timestamps will be in the description. Agamonia comes from publisher Lauterpellet.fi by designer Max Wickstrom, with art by Petri Hiltunen, Chad Hoveter, Tomasz Jedruszek, Jera Kasanen, and Damon Mamoliti.
Valiant attempt.
It was awful. Please don't write in and tell me how to actually do tell me how to pronounce these names, then I'll learn for next time.
As a member of the Baltic language group, I think the most primed to recognize that the Finno-Ugric language group is incredibly difficult.
I mean, not all of that was Finnish.
Well, no, that's true, yeah, but still,
tell us about the game, Efka.
Okay, so I want to start by saying that this is becoming a bit of a BGG darling at the moment. I think just a lot of conversations around this game, and I can kind of understand where that stems from. And I think maybe this summary will kind of shine a good light on what it actually is in just a few words. It has the ethos of Gloomhaven and Descent Second Edition combined. So it's a dungeon crawler, and it riffs on both of those together at the same time. And I think that makes it very understandable as to why this game is hitting the hotness.
Mm.
Yeah.
A lot of interest, yeah.
I wanted to say that because I want to say that, of course, this is very early impressions. We played the first three tutorial missions, and this is kind of like our initial thoughts, and we might potentially have more thoughts on it in video later. But I have to say, for me personally, it is not a campaign game that does what I want a campaign game to do, or like a fantasy dungeon crawler style campaign game. And it does a lot of things right. It is clearly very imaginative. There is...
I mean, we'll get into that a lot more later.
A lot of world building, but also it is old-fashioned in ways that I personally don't appreciate. So I'm immediately seeing things in it that I'm like, I wish this wasn't like that. So you know, if you're enjoying this game, if you're a fan of this game, more power to you. You know, have a wild time. But we're probably going to go over some things that didn't quite... some things that we did like, but also some things that didn't quite, you know, make us feel like, oh yeah, this is amazing, and more like, oh, I just wish this was a little different, you know. So that's the preface for the discussion, right? So Agamonia, big, expansive fantasy world,
big box,
right? I mean, Frosthaven size, right? Like, and similar dimensions as well. I'm not going to say it's like, oh, it's the exact dimensions, because it probably isn't. But
just, I could hide in it. It's one of those boxes that I could probably hide in.
Yeah, exactly, right? So there is immediately this sort of like, you get this on the table and it's like, whoa, this is going to be a lot of the things, right? So just like in many of these fantasy campaign dungeon crawler board games, you will pick a character. There is a roster of 7. Narratively, you can tell that they're all very different. And you can tell that by the fact that when you open the official Agamonia campaign app, which does some campaign tracking and also some audio narration, you know, by voice actors of the intros and outros of the scenarios, there is also a little blurb on each character. But on top of the blurb, and I think this is a big hint as to how expansive this game is trying to be, there is a backstory for each character, fully narrated, that it ranges anywhere between from 35 to 50 minutes.
Well, my one was for Torox was only, I think, 20-something minutes, 27 minutes.
Okay, so, but still near the...
around half an hour.
Yeah, yeah. But I looked... Well,
they are full audiobooks. They are described as audiobooks, not just like character background. It says audiobooks. So that it gives you an idea of what to expect from it.
And if you want to know whether the writing style and the writing of Agamonia is for you, you don't even have to, like, you know, listen to this podcast. You can just download this app for free and have a listen to these backstories.
Alternatively, you can find them on YouTube. The Agamonia channel on YouTube has all the backstories on it, has all the audiobooks on it.
Okay, you don't even need to download the app and burn through your phone's battery.
Which is what I did, yeah. Because you can't turn the screen off, because otherwise it's stops the app, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I had to have the screen on. And yeah, I went from 100% to 66% listening to 2 stories.
Okay, so before we get into the mechanisms, why don't you share your impressions of these stories? Because I haven't listened to them. I want to know, right? And maybe we can segue a little bit into what us felt about the writing.
I kind of struggled with the stories, if I'm honest, even with the choosing which character. It's a bit like, you know, if someone says to you, okay, I want you to write an essay about cheese, but give me a brief first about what you're gonna talk about in the essay, and you go, well, I don't know, because I haven't written the essay yet.
Uh-huh.
It kind of was that sort of feeling, because there was so much new wording that I had not experienced before.
Lots
of capital letter nouns, things that you weren't supposed to know what they were because you had never played this game, but also it made it, for me, for my own brain, quite confusing. But I did manage to pick a character based on their tiny, tiny little bit of blurb. But I did find that there was nothing that I could relate to within that character immediately. Like you know when you have like a D&D sort of setting and there's a lot of words that you don't know, but also it does use words that are maybe kind of faux oldie worldy, like a flagon of ale in a tank or whatever, in an inn. You know,
isn't this, a flagon like, of ale a tankard? Are they not the same thing?
Yes, they are. A flagon of ale or a tankard of ale in an inn. There we go.
Uh-huh.
Sorry, I was getting confused by the in an inn thing. Like it was the sentence structure confused my brain. But so there are things you can kind of relate to in that sense. You might not know exactly what they are, but you have an idea of what is happening. And I found that quite difficult because a lot of that isn't present. And I said to you, it's a bit like trying to read the Silmarillion before you actually read Lord of the Rings or anything else.
I don't think the Silmarillion is any better after you read Lord of the Rings. But
that's kind of how it felt. There was so much information in these backstories, which I know some people have really enjoyed and gone, this is brilliant, this is great. But I couldn't get over, and I don't know if this is because I'm not used to reading fantasy fiction so much. I don't know. But it was very much like my character, Torax, is an Ogorian. They are made of rock. And at one point he says, like, we don't eat, we don't drink, we don't defecate. And I thought, that's too much information. Like, I don't...
Sorry.
I don't
know
why...
we don't defecate?
Yes.
This is like Ulysses all over again.
And then he says, like, am I real? Am I a real thing? I'm just made of rock. Like, it was just like, oh, please, you know, this isn't really the story I want. And so I found the stories quite, I mean, I only listened to two of them, to be fair, because I only listened to my one for my character and your character, who is called, what's their name?
Venia,
I think it is.
Is it Venia?
I think it was Venia,
okay.
In the story, yeah. But, I mean, it's your character, call it what you like, who is a Quothian, right?
Because they're raven-like, get it? Quothian the raven.
The Corvidine.
I'm gonna be okay. I think you're dancing around the subject. I think this is by far some of the worst writing I have encountered in a campaign style board game. There is a lot, and I don't want to be mean, because I think again, in the imagination department, clearly,
out there,
you know, 1000%, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there's just clearly been a lot of thought put into everything, but the quality of the writing itself,
and that I found a sticking point.
I felt very clumsy. And you know, when writing is worse than Gloomhaven, you know, and I say that with love to Gloomhaven as well, you know, I think Isaac knows, you know, that Gloomhaven's writing has never been a strong point. The imagination, again, was always there and always good, but this is worse. I think this is worse. This is maybe on par with Descent Second Edition, which was, you know, zany is the best adjective I can come up with. Stayed would be a more appropriate one. And this is stayed, but clumsy as well. And so I take no joy or pleasure in saying this,
no,
right? I wanted the writing itself to be better. There's a lot of info dumping and exposition.
Yes.
Just everywhere, all the time. And then when it isn't doing that, when it's trying to advance the plot, it feels very clumsy. You know, there were moments in the game where, you know, suddenly we're bombarded, like, out of nowhere, right? This random character says to us, I am the only one who can save Agamonia. And I'm like, and that being the whole continent,
the party.
Right?
No, yeah, sorry. Yeah.
That being the whole continent and or the world, even, you know, like, I don't know what Agamonia, I still haven't read enough to find out what Agamonia, whether it's the whole world or just like this continent.
Well,
I don't the world.
Feel like I have, really.
Yeah. It's immediately a lot, but so abruptly that, like, it just feels very clumsy. And I know I keep saying the word clumsy over and over again. I'm being clumsy myself, but this is a podcast. It's fine. So I don't know. I didn't dig it. I'll be very honest with you. And for me, that's one thing I'm kind of starting to look for in these fantasy campaign style dungeon crawly board games. You know, Oathsworn set the gold standard now, but also Artisans of Splendid Vale. I liked Artisans of Splendid Vale mechanically less than even this game, but the writing department, you know, was a home run, right? And also, you have games like Kinfire, which I thought did an okay job. You know, it was certainly interesting and engrosting. Even Frosthaven picked up its chops, you know, from Gloomhaven, and in some ways I think succeeded a bit more, in some ways succeeded a bit less than Gloomhaven. But you know, it felt stronger, you know. People are trying to write, Earthborn Rangers, of course, we have a video for that coming very soon. You know, this does a very different take on delivering a fantasy narrative, right? It tries to deliver it via mechanisms rather than exposition. And I felt that was very interesting, you know? Agamonia feels like a step back. It does not feel... There is a lot of the writing, and if all you want was to get invested in the world, You could do that. Do you know what this actually reminds me the most of? Mm. I just thought, struck my head. Aeon's End, the deck building legacy game. It's Legacy of Greyfold. We played that, right, a little bit. The writing felt similar to that, but with, you know, there's quite a lot of typos and also production errors within the text. So, yeah, that's what that felt like to me. But again, listen for yourself. It's, available.
On that point, the audio narration does not always correspond to what the writing is, which is annoying for me because, like you, you know, I like to read along with the words, as it's almost like having subtitles is what I want, really. And when the words are very different from what is being said, it's a little bit like my brain just sticks on that and can't listen to the rest of the story. Plus, you cannot, not that I have found, rewind. You can rewind the audiobooks, but you cannot rewind parts of the spoken narration. Or you can't pause it. So if the doorbell rings, oh, you've just missed it, you know, or whatever. Or if you've missed quite what it meant, you can't, you have to listen to the whole thing all over again, which I find a little bit annoying. I almost feel like I want some sort of, what do you call it? Like a travel guide. There we go. Travel guide to Agamonia. Because like you said, you know, there are bits of text and bits of the gameplay that reveal more things about the world.
Yeah.
But like, if I live in this world, then would I not know roughly about these things anyway? Like what these things do? And the narration and the audiobooks are very much about the people, which is nice, but I'm not getting a sense of the world because the world is so massive. I guess it would be like saying, we'll do a travel guide of Earth. You know, you can't. Right. I don't know.
But I think that's the point of a travel guide. It's meant to, and when I say travel guide, I mean like a specifically like a fantasy world building trope, right?
You mean like
Elminster's Guide to Faerun or whatever?
Yeah, that kind of thing.
Stuff like that, you know? Mm. There is
Volo's
a way.
Guide.
Yeah, Volo's Guide. There's a way to do this that is a great tool for storytellers who are doing world building, right? Mm. Where you don't dump everything into the travel guide. You just give the best bits, the highlights, so that it tantalizes. And then, you know, you can have that stuff in the background. You don't need to bombard the audience with everything. And I think, you know, on the one hand, it does show people, you know, like, oh, there's a lot here, right? But not everyone wants to absorb that a lot at the same time. I don't know.
And Kinfire, I thought, did that pretty well.
Yeah, Kinfire did that very well as well. Anyway, let's move on to something more positive, which is how this game plays out. Much like Gloomhaven or Frosthaven or, you know, Descent, it's scenario-based. So you have a scenario that's kind of like your mission, but you will not necessarily fight in this scenario. You could, but maybe not. The fight might not be part of the entire scenario, but it is fluid. It takes place on a book. There is a map on a book. You move your miniatures. There are spaces. And so the investigative part of the scenario is combined together with the combat part of the scenario. Even there might not even be combat, right? It depends on what the scenario is. Now, mechanically, I really like this investigative part because I think it works very fluidly and it has a lot of things going for it. I think the system is cool, right? So you have this map, and on this map, there are points of interest, right? These points of interest are marked as numbers, and those numbers are range. So, for example, there might be, like, let's say, a piece of crumbling ruins, right? And on those ruins is a number one, right? Now, that means that when any character is within one tile of those ruins, right, they will flip a card with a corresponding letter. And that card will, it's like this big size card. It'll have some text, maybe a picture. It will give you a better idea what's in these ruins. Oh, there might be something under the rocks, you know. And then the card itself will say, well, when you're in range zero of this card, meaning you're on the same tile as the ruins, you could flip it. And that would mean, you know, like digging in the rubble and seeing what's under those rocks. It's something like that, you know, and it plays out in very different ways because it drives all of the interaction with the scenario, and it hides all the puzzles it hides like maybe combat, you know, because you encounter something that's not entirely friendly to you, you know, and you won't know that until you actually move into this place. So the scope of play itself feels very investigative. You move towards things, you don't know what they are yet, you will uncover them, and like something will happen. And that kind of feels fluid. It also has a cool initiative system. So at the beginning of the round, you will all select what action you want to do by putting this like little plastic disc onto whichever action you're trying to perform. So for example, we had actions available like, oh, hey, you could perform two maneuvers instead of the requisite one. So it means you could move and rest or double move or whatever, you know. Another action could be that, hey, you get to fire from your like magic wand or whatever, or, you know, hit with a melee weapon. So you would get one maneuver, which could be moving or it could be like resting or whatever. And then, you know, one attack against an enemy. If there is an enemy present, you know, maybe that's an action that you want to select. If there isn't an enemy present, maybe you want to select something else, you know, maybe a double maneuver so you can investigate more. And then as you level up, the amount of these actions that you get, you know, will increase and you will get to choose different ones. So, you know, an interesting system. But on top of that, each of these actions are coded in a color: red, green, and blue. When everyone selects an action, you will flip an initiative card and it'll say which of these colors goes first. So it might say, oh, hey, all the reds go first. And it's usually red that goes first. And then I believe then blues and then greens or something like that. But that
it's a general
might not,
rule.
Yeah, it's a general rule.
Always, yeah.
Yeah, it might not be true. Because you played a rock person, right, Torax. Mm-hmm. So you were going into green a lot. And most of the time it's like, well, I'm going last. But sometimes you're like, hey, I'm first.
Yeah.
You know, so I thought it's a neat initiative system. And then when there are enemies, they'll be interspersed in various ways between those as well. You know, so some enemies are faster. And then also, like, the initiative card kind of determines what action they perform, because they have multiple actions. So they might be, like, you know, swooping in fast. So you need to make, like, basically a dexterity save. Or, you know, maybe they're just trying to, you know, jump and grab you. So you need to make a strength save. And, you know, it's stuff like that, right? So I like this initiative system, and I like the exploration system. I don't know about you. How do you feel about
that? There was a lot about this that I did like. I like that it was in a book instead of having tiles that you have to try and find in a box and then lay out. And I realized that that makes the world smaller in some ways, that it's not as dynamic. You can't lay tiles out in whatever configuration you want. Like, it's a printed page on a book. But there are things that change that and amend that. So that I found quite interesting. I like also that, and I always appreciate it in a game where combat isn't the be all and end all. So that the whole point of the scenario isn't just fighting off something or other, right? There's another different goal or project that you're doing. But the enemies just come out and you have to sort of beat them off as you go, right? And the scenario designs felt very different. So we played only through three, like you said, and they were the intro scenarios, but the different types of maps all felt very different. They didn't feel samey, you know?
Yeah.
They had different kind of things to interact with. They had different environmental aspects going on within them and different things that came out when you read a certain number. And I really liked, actually, that you didn't have to be on the same square. They're not squares. They're sort of, they're like Tony's Chocolate Only, you know, like, rather than being just squares or whatever, they're higgledy-piggledy shapes. But I like that you didn't have to be
Elaine,
on the same.
I'm sorry. I really love that. That was great. Like Tony's Chocolate Only.
It is. It's that kind of weird, crazy paving type system.
People are going to think we're in the pocket of Tony Chocolate Only.
I mean, they are nice. But
they're okay.
I really like, but they're very good. You know, they pay their work as well and stuff. I appreciate them. Anyway, that was not my point.
Uh-huh.
But my point was, now I've forgotten. Thank you. you. No, my point was that it was nice that there was something maybe a square away or a couple of squares away that you could interact with, or you could, because in real life you would, like, you could see a car in the distance, couldn't you? You wouldn't have to be like a meter away from the car to be able to see it. You would be able to see it, you know, 10 meters away or whatever. So I like that about it. And then if you wanted to interact with it, you might have to move closer to it. But if it was something that maybe wasn't helpful to you at the time, you could go off and do something else. I like that about the scenario design.
I will say one thing for combat. It doesn't super outstay its welcome, right? It's not super slow.
But
I didn't like it. I didn't like it. I'm sorry. Maybe that's partly because we're on the tutorial, right? You know, and not a lot of combat abilities have been revealed. But so far, it has been a lot of roll some dice, see how much damage you do.
Yeah.
And I didn't feel like I could, like we got a couple of interesting weapons, right, towards the end of that whole tutorial thing. But they weren't, like, super fascinating or exciting. They were just clearly better. And it's like, oh, well, I used that one because that one's clearly better.
Right, but I think from a meta story world perspective of it, we are not... We didn't come together as, like, adventurers in quotation marks. So we don't necessarily have...
Quotathian marks.
Nice. You're very derailing today.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, in quotathian marks. So it's likely that we will find things as we go.
Yeah.
And they will be more interesting weapons. They will be have more interesting things to do with them than what we're doing, which is just whacking someone with a shovel
but
or
like
whatever.
And that's the thing. I think a lot of... But the problem is, it's okay, so when you attack something, right, you are told how many dice you roll, and then the weapon that you have, you know, might modify the hits. There is, like in Descent, a special symbol on a die, and so far it is spend some stamina and, like, turn that into successes. But I am, like, absolutely certain that there will be future abilities that will manipulate that symbol in some sort of ways. And it'll say, like, hey, do this, right? I just don't find that very interesting. I find that very 2008, you know? Like, it feels... about a decade behind, when we have had so many different systems that have advanced on that idea, right? And did something more interesting. Now it is, like, even if you get future abilities, well, what will it do? Will it modify how many successes we get? Will it modify, like, oh, if you attack at this range, you get more successes? Or, you know, or you get to roll an extra die, maybe, right? You know, but it is still, roll a die, see how much damage to a monster you do, equal to successes, right? I just don't find that exciting or interesting. I think, also the main advantage that board games have over role-playing games in terms of playing this expansive fantasy campaign. That, you know, unlike role-playing games, you can have these advanced, interesting systems that make the combat very tactical, like in Gloomhaven, like in Oathsworn, like even in Kinfire, which the system was very simple, but it felt tactical, right? Here, there is nothing of the sort. It is roll die, see what number you get.
Yeah, no, that's true. And actually, we don't have anything at the moment that seems to change how good we are with any kind of weapon. We were given, I don't think this is much of a spoiler, we were given a shovel. I've already mentioned this at the beginning. And if you had the shovel, you did the same sort of, like, it depended on your action that you took as to how much damage dice you would be rolling. But the actual shovel itself didn't change based on who had it. Do you know what I did like? That we had a shovel and we could dig with it, but also use it to hit things. I thought that was very, like, that's a real world thing.
Right? Yeah, yeah. There are items and weapons as well. Mm. And I mean, all weapons are items in this game. But you know, like, they can be used in different ways. Like, again, and it comes back to this nifty system of, like, when you're in range of something, you will see what that is. And then when you're closer, you might be able to interact with it. And the map is very dynamic and environmental in that regard. And then keying off of various things like, oh, hey, do you have, like, you know, a hook and rope? Oh, you do. Okay. You can climb this thing now, right? It's like, cool.
And actually, that I think that was necessary in some ways, because I think it would have been a lot more frustrating. I already found it a little bit frustrating, but I think it would have been a lot more frustrating if you'd have had to gone into the same square of something. And then it said, okay, you require a shovel to be able to do this. And then you'd been like, well, I haven't got it and you've got it and you're halfway across the other side of the map. So what am I doing now? So if you can see it within two squares, you can go, okay, I'll leave this for you. I'll just put this card on the table and you can interact with it when you get a bit closer to it.
Well, as a tutorial, it was frustrating because there was a lot of trial and error. But, like, I guess it does, you know, and the tutorial isn't short. It is free sessions, but, like, the third session was quite long, you know.
I think it was a good couple of hours, didn't it?
At least, you know. Yeah, I think we spent, like, a good 3 hours on it or something like that. So it wasn't nothing, right? But it does, you know, kind of like teach you through this trial and error element of like, hey, you know, like, do you see a cliff? Maybe if you don't have a hook and rope, don't go next to it. Maybe the other character should go to it. Which brings me to kind of my point number two, and what I didn't like about Agamonia is the scaling between player counts.
Oh, yeah.
So it does some scaling, right? So, for example, if there are more monsters, they have more hit points, therefore more hit point sponges. But, like, if there are less players, there are less hit points. Okay. But the amount of monsters you have is the same regardless of player count. Now, I don't want to get too nitty gritty, but, like, here's a very simple example of why the scaling isn't, like, so great. So, yes, okay, these monsters have less hit points, right? But whether you're playing with four characters or with two characters, it's still four monsters, right? So when four monsters are attacking two characters, yes, they are easier to kill, but it still takes some time, right? So, you know, there's four things hitting two people versus four things hitting four people, right? Those two players get a lot more punished. Combat becomes much harder. But that scaling doesn't just extend to the combat itself. It also extends to the scenario design. And within the scenario design, scaling almost doesn't come into play. There is a big map in each scenario of a lot of things to explore. And whether you have two people exploring them or four people exploring them, that's a very different number, right? That's like, you're with four people, you're going to trigger things twice as fast because
you can. Well, the game encourages you actually to split off.
Yes.
To split the party, which is something we've always been told not to do.
But yeah, no, it does it on the first scenario.
First scenario, it encourages you to split the party, and which is something if you're playing with two players, you can't do as well as it is if you're playing with four. You could investigate more things and maybe find out things that we didn't find out that might have been helpful to us. And I think that was a bit of a sticking point for us.
Yeah. Minor point. I don't know. How do you feel about the whole stamina and health system?
I really like it. But can I just mention one thing before we move on to stamina and health? Because I do really like it. I like the system very much. But I just wanted to say that the designer of this game has put an errata on BGG, like quite a lengthy errata about the timer mechanism in a two-player game, because in a two-player game the timer there's parts of the game where the game asks you to kind of set a timer, and that's based on numbers that you draw on cards, which you will draw one card at the end of each round, and if you're playing with two players, those will trigger far more often than if you were playing with four players. Like, that's just maths, right? And so the designer has put an errata on of various scenarios that have timers that have been mitigated or changed for a two-player count. So I thought that was good because it was in response to player feedback, And I thought that was good that they kind of took that to heart and changed it based on that. I just wanted to say that. Anyway, so yes, the stamina and wounding mechanism, I like that a lot because it's not often in a game where your stamina is kind of your wounds as well. And you can spend your stamina, and the game encourages you to spend these stamina chips. They're just like poker chips. And you can spend them to do various things. But they are also, if you are wounded, they will flip to their other side and become red. And then if all of those are used up, you will take a wound. And I just thought it was very clever because you're balancing how much stamina do I have left? What can I do with it? And will I be taking damage from whatever's around me?
Well, you probably want to spend this stamina.
Well, yeah, because if you spend it, it doesn't automatically sort of go away. You can then still flip it into wounds.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you might as well spend it on your actions because you're going to take damage from it anyway. So I just thought that was very clever.
I like the system. I thought that was it's a minor point, but it was one of the things that made, I don't know, it's a little bit of like brain work, busy work, you know? But in a way that feels like fun rather than annoying. So I enjoyed that. And
I enjoy admin anyway.
Yeah,
so.
Well, yeah. But, it does kind of push you in a direction to be a little bit more reckless and a little bit more carefree with what you're doing. And I think actually that's very clever design. And that's really neat. But this whole thing boils down into one thing that kind of is really preventing me from enjoying the game. This narrative, I appreciate that for different, some people don't care for the quality of narrative or come to expect, you know, not high quality narrative in board game campaign games. My question is why can't we have better? People have been trying to do better. So, you know, but for some, I appreciate some people, this is not going to be a sticking point. It is a sticking point for me. The scaling that doesn't, yeah, kind of mesh with player count because it's you are rewarded for having more players. And this all boils down to in this one final point, and that's the whole idea of fail forward you know, role-playing games and TTRPGs specifically, and also, you know, moving more into board games. So the designer clearly knows the concept of fail forward because there is a game mechanism in this game called fail forward. The irony of that mechanism being called fail forward is that it isn't actually fail forward. It's just fail, right? The way it plays out in Agamonia, because you can succeed at the scenario and you can fail at the scenario. And if you fail at the scenario, you are worse off. And then if you succeed at the scenario, you are better off. But the mechanism of fail forward is that no matter what you do, you get to proceed. But so that mechanically is represented. But the spirit of fail forward is that regardless of whether you succeed or you fail, you get to proceed, but you get to proceed in different directions, not necessarily worse off or better off, that it splits the narrative. It pushes you in different avenues and it becomes a part of your story. That is very much not present in Agamonia. And in fact, we have encountered a very persistent sort of ethos of like, hey, did you succeed at this? Well, good, because that's going to make going forward easier. Did you fail at this? That's going to make going forward harder. And then it just snowballs. And it has snowballed for us.
I disagree with you very slightly, right? I know what you're saying. But what's weird is that the game seems to have this fail forward system, but only specifically when the game tells you you're going to have a fail forward system. It's not pervasive. It's not a spirit in the game. It's not something that just goes throughout the game. It's when the game says you failed, but this mechanism says you fail forward. And I find that very weird because, like you said, there were things that we didn't do or didn't get that made our game harder. But I don't know, because we haven't played enough, whether those things will will just be a branching path in the future. So because there are things that, like, you write down different entries for your, like, journal or whatever it's called. So I don't know if those things are just going to be a different way the game will go, like a different direction the game will
go. So far, it just felt punitive.
But we've only done the tutorial. But yes, but that's what I do agree with you, that the things that we didn't get were punitive because they were referenced, they were referred to in the next scenario. And if you don't have this, you're worse off.
Mm.
So that was, I don't know if I agree with you is my conclusion on that. Like, I know what you're saying, but I don't, for me, I don't feel like I've played enough of it to know whether that's true or not.
I agree with you on that. Yeah, this jury remains out on that, you know. but again, this is first impressions, and that's how we felt so far, you know. And you know, putting it together, I appreciate the creativity. There is a lot of it. There is very expansive. I know that there is that scenarios are going to be splitting off, and we're going to have, you know, like, choose whatever adventure you want to go on next, you know, kind of thing. And I know that there's a whole, like, road encounters like you have in Gloomhaven, you know, where, like, things happen and, you know, as you're along the way towards the adventure. I know that...
Along the way.
Yeah, that's Earthborn Rangers. I know that... you know, it's going to open up after this tutorial.
Yeah.
And you know, and I suspect that we're going to have, like, I got a very clear sense that there is, like, two ways we can progress our characters. And they're yours went places.
Yeah. Yeah. This is one of the reasons why I felt like I really needed to read more of the background, or hear more of the background of my own character, was because... So, and I don't think this is a spoiler at all, because, like, literally we've just played through the tutorial scenarios and, you know, I've read the book. But yeah, my character, Torax, is an Agurian, and the Agurians are in a difficult position because they have this crystal on them that they have been, like, has been a trading resource for a long time, and they've I don't know if they've been hunted necessarily for, but I think they've been killed for it in the past. And then there was this person that, I don't know, came from the mountains or whatever, and decided that because we have this resource, we are the superior race. And so this person killed or enslaved lots of different people, and held some prisoner, and it was a hideous person. But it turns out from the audiobook that I am this person, because most of my species have like runes and memories engraved into their rocky skin, but I don't, for some reason. Why don't I? Ah, because I'm this monster person. And I don't know. It just was like, ah.
You're Darth Revan from Knights of the Old Republic.
The game says to you, are you gonna be the good guy or the bad guy, is what it says. And I don't know if that is a real thing. It just reminded me of, you know the film Look Who's Back? You ever seen that?
No.
It's where Hitler wakes up, like, now. And like, I don't know, this monster wakes up now. Because that's effectively what I have done. I've been asleep. These rock people sleep for eons or whatever. And they just wake up, and I don't have any memory. And neither did this Hitler character in Look Who's Back, right? And it's like, well, what do I do now? Like, do I continue my path as I was before, or do I become, like, a really good person now? So it was just a bit like, oh God, what is the game going to do with this?
Yeah. And the clumsy writing doesn't make you feel confident about that, right?
No, yeah. Exactly. And the thing is, like, the Quothians as well, and it says that... female Quothians are, like, superior, and they treat the male counterparts like cattle, and they're effectively, like, non-human, but they're not human, you know what I mean? They're not equals at all.
They used to be, but never more.
Ha 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 ha. Very good, very good. But I don't know. It just feels a bit icky. But I don't know. Again, like the clunky writing definitely does not give me
confidence
in this. Yeah. But I always do have a problem with when a certain species or race of people in like a fantasy setting are all this way. Like, you know, I don't know, all elves are friendly and luminescent and good with bows or whatever, you know, this kind of thing that always, and they all speak elven or whatever.
Yeah, so, Gygax casts a long shadow.
So, you know, maybe what this world is doing is trying to represent more of what we actually experience in our own world. I don't know.
But you have to be very...
And it gives me
very,
the clues a little bit.
Yeah, you
right?
have to be so, very careful in how you do that. I think.
Yeah, and right, and that goes back to this kind of not excellent writing. It needs to be done in such a way that it comes across in the way that it was meant.
Yeah.
And I'm not inspired to believe that this will happen.
Neither am I, you know... I don't know. And it feels very harsh to say this because I've said this 1,000 times. Once again, clearly, like, the imagination is big and wide, you know, and clearly a labor of love, right? You can tell that this box was definitely, you know, someone worked over this years and years and years and years, you know. So it's kind of weird to criticize it in that way, because some of it does feel good and interesting and strong, but a lot of it also doesn't, you know, like, inspire excitement or confidence in it. It's kind of put like me in a weird position. I don't know if I want to explore this game more after the tutorial, you know? Like, I kind of want to go back to Divinity Original Sin, the board game, because mechanically, right? So I know the story is going to be, you know, all right, because it's the story of Divinity Original Sin, but number two, the video game. And, like, you know, Larian has more than once proven their chops that they're capable storytellers, right? So I kind of want to go back to that instead, but also because mechanically it's just a little bit more interesting for a roll some dice, you know, fantasy adventure campaign game that actually works in very many similar ways, but has also a learn to play tutorial like Agamonia that is less reading and less rules, but somehow more mechanical grit. Right, like the mechanisms feel more interesting because of this whole, and that was in the video game as well, but there's these whole elements, and, you know, hey, it's throw some water on some fire, it disables the water, that kind of thing, you know, all these elements cohabiting together and abilities triggering off of each other and adding bonuses to the other, and so you kind of think about how you're gonna like combine things and, you know, what sequence and order you're going to do them in. And it does it in so much less rules, right? That I'm kind of like, well, why would I play this, you know, like bigger, more kind of clumsy game, right? When there's a leaner version of it on my shelves. So I'm actually torn on whether I'm going to return to Agamonia. And
yeah, we are, aren't we?
Yeah.
Yeah, we're not sure.
But if we will, then there will be a video. And if we don't, then there will be a video on Divinity Original Sin, the board game. So you can figure out what happened by what comes out on No Pun Included.
Before we move on to Terra Nova, I just want to thank everyone who emailed in about Salt and Sea and the issues around lithium mining. It is a much bigger subject than we could or should tackle in a podcast, but I just wanted to read out this email from Alexander. There's a lot of information here, but I hope you'll agree it's worth listening to. Alexander says, I listened to your recent podcast episode, Salt and Sea Arcs, today, and I quite enjoyed it. It isn't every day that a board game podcast touches on my area of research, lithium-ion batteries. I will note that I am coming from this at a perspective of a scientist, not an industry insider. I did want to note that, although cobalt is used in the majority of lithium-ion batteries, about 70%, there is a sizable minority of batteries using iron phosphate instead, about 30% as of 2023, according to the International Energy Agency. Researchers are also working on other battery types that could have even lower environmental impacts, such as sulfur batteries and, even better, sodium-based batteries instead of lithium. I also want to note that, to the best of my knowledge, there is no particular reason why cobalt mining needs to be so environmentally and socially destructive. It just so happens that the largest and most accessible cobalt deposits are in the DRC, where mining companies have entrenched themselves in a system that allows them to exploit the community and the environment with very little pushback. There are some attempts to improve the situation, but unfortunately, that fight has yet to have a huge impact. Furthermore, as Elaine noted in the podcast, lithium mining can also be very destructive. As far as I understand, this issue is not limited to lithium or cobalt mining, but is a problem for mining in general. Digging up lots of minerals from the ground will always carry large risks for negative environmental impacts, and safety and community engagement will always be something that occasionally stands in the way of profits, and thus mining companies will tend to oppose them. Even if mining is done responsibly, one of the ongoing issues in the USA, even in areas where authorities want to hold the mining companies accountable, is the complexity of closing a mine. Oftentimes, filling in the hole is not feasible, but leaving the mine open can also lead to new dangers, as the mines will typically fill up with water. Just search sites like the Berkeley Pit or even just mine closure Toxic Lake, and you will find reports of multiple closed mines where the mine has filled with water, which then causes various toxic chemicals to leach out into the water, where it can then cause issues for wildlife and people who might interact with the lake. As of now, we don't have any effective method of fully cleaning up such sites and returning them to their pre-mine state. Instead, these toxic lakes become a long-term health hazard that must be fenced in and warned about, typically at government expense. Unlike with operational mines, this issue cannot be effectively resolved with fines or taxes, as the mine is already closed and no longer profitable. The only solution is for communities to hopefully learn from past mistakes and design policies so that mining companies must take action to assure a successful closure before the mine is actually closed, such as creating a mine closure fund. All of this is a difficult process. While I understand the desire to avoid these issues, I am of the belief that engaging in these topics is the only way for the broader community to honestly come to grips with issues facing our communities and work together to come up with better solutions. In many cases, scientific methods for a better system already exist, but science alone will not solve the issues. We also need community organising and the political willpower to implement less profitable but more humane and environmentally friendly processes. I also think that your podcast shows how engaging with such issues can be beneficial. If you had not played Salt and Sea, would you have taken the time to research lithium and cobalt mining? Although, from your description, Salt and Sea sounds a little biased. If it leads to more people critically engaging with the benefits and drawbacks of lithium batteries, I think it will be a net positive.
That last point, I think, is the most important one. And what I wanted Salt and Sea to be was something that presents information on how complex the issue is, and it did the opposite. It was like, hey, it's great. And actually, we have received a couple more. We received a lot of correspondences, some positive, some not so much. And there were a couple of emails that one comment, one email that really kind of went for like, oh, you know, you're just falling for the fossil fuel propaganda. And I'm sorry, I know that the fossil fuel companies have a lot of propaganda, and they would exactly try to undermine, you know, more greener industries. But the problem with lithium mining is that it isn't necessarily greener. Maybe it could be, right? But if we don't talk about the things that it's doing that are not good, we're just replacing one catastrophe for another catastrophe. So I understand not wanting, and what I really don't get is the binary thinking and the duality. Oh boy, if you're not one, you're for the other. No, maybe it's not that. Maybe it's just like we're trying to find a solution that works. And I think this email alluded to that as well, like finding a solution that works. And one way of doing that is making audiences more informed about the potential positive benefits, but also, you know, we need to see the pitfalls. We need to see where it can all go wrong, right? And Salt and Sea absolutely does not do that, right? It has no information whatsoever on what the detrimental effects of lithium mining could be. So I think it's a big miss. I don't know. How do you feel about it?
I think we spoke a lot about how we felt about the game before, so I don't want to talk about that again. But I appreciate what the email said, and it is something that I said to you right at the end, was that if we hadn't played Salt and Sea, we would have never spoken about this. We would have never even, it wouldn't have even passed our minds, honestly. So, yeah. So, you know, learning about things through games is a good thing. Yeah,
it is. But the game needs to do more work. That so we shouldn't have had to have done this research. And ours was incomplete. We missed the whole thing about, you know, cobalt not being used in all batteries. Right, yeah. But 70% is still a lot. It's a big number. Right? Yeah. That's not insignificant. I
guess, like, the only thing that we know, like, anyway, without being, you know, part of this industry, is that you don't put batteries in the bin. But I don't know why you don't put batteries in the bin. That's why you don't put batteries in the bin, because they go off to be recycled, maybe. And because they've got horrible chemicals in them. If the weather's good.
Yeah, you know, they'll get recycled.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
With a fair wind and a...
Yeah.
I see what you mean. Yeah, but no, I thought that was a very interesting email. And I do appreciate everyone that wrote in about Salt and Sea and lithium mining. If you have anything to say about the games in this or previous episodes, email me, elaine@nopunincluded.com. Let's talk about our last game of the episode. Terra Nova comes from publisher Capstone Games by designer Andreas Fall, with art by Loic Bilau, Inga Koitman, Lucas Siegmund, and Christoph Tisch.
Finally, my Terra Mystica collection is complete!
Is that how you feel?
It's all right.
Why did you look like Scrooge McDuck then?
Is that who I was channeling?
I don't know. I don't know.
I didn't know. I sounded like David Tennant, but
not sounded like, looked like.
Looked like. Ah, that's
like, you know,
worse.
That scene where he's swimming through the coins?
Yeah.
It was like that. That was your eyes. That's what your eyes were doing.
Okay. I thought you said I sounded like David Tennant. That would have been a compliment. Now you said I look like a cartoon duck. It's all right. You know, I had a nice time. I don't want to. So I'm in a very weird position about this game, because it is a part of a series that I really love. I'm not going to go over the rules for Terra Mystica. So I'm just going to, I'm really sorry. I'm going to just compare Terra Nova to Terra Mystica. If you're not familiar with Terra Mystica, we spoke about Age of Innovation in a previous episode, and in somewhere in previous episodes of the podcast, we've covered what Terra Mystica is. So please go listen to those. And I think a lot of people are familiar with Terra Mystica, right? But this is a streamlined, simplified version that's made to be a jumping on point for people who are not comfortable with a heavy Euro game, right? So this is a medium Euro game. This is very medium. And for me, it's also very mid. But for someone who hasn't played like a heavy Euro game, or Terra Mystica specifically, right, is new to that, who this product is aimed for, I think it's not going to be mid for them. I think it's going to be great, you know? It's a great little game. It's a great little package. It's very succinctly succeeds at simplifying the system and still making it an interesting game. It's just that I imagine you as well, right, we've played all the Terra Mysticas. We've gotten into the grit of it, right? All these greebly bits, right? That are these edge cases that let
greebly.
You kind of go like, ooh, like here and there, and oh, I can do this and manipulate this like that. And, you know, like that is missing, right? And that is, to me, now the appeal of this system. Mm-hmm. But where I needing a jumping on point... Oh wow, this is pretty good, right? This is very good.
I read a comment, and I can't remember where I read this, or I mean somewhere on the internet, but I don't remember what the website was. But the comment said, and I think this was before the game came out, and it was something like, it's the ethos of Terra Mystica or Age of Innovation, but with the complexity of Catan.
Yeah,
and I thought that was quite a good summary of it, actually.
Yeah, I would say that. Yeah, yeah. So let's talk about it in relation to Terra Mystica, and specifically what is missing and what it achieves by shaving all of that off, right? So to those familiar, so there's now only just one resource. So you have just money. And that's it. You know, there was only money. No cubes. And the costs have been adjusted, so everything costs more money, but it's just money. So that's an easy point of simplification, right? All of the tracks are gone, right? Which is kind of nice.
You don't like tracks anyway.
I don't like tracks anyway, yeah. But you know, they were an extra point of contention, because the point of contention on Terra Mystica is the map, right? But there is an extra point of contention, and that dilutes your attention, right? Which is obviously more complex, but also in a way more interesting, right? Here, there's just one point of tension, which is the map, right? And the map is all that matters. So on the map, you build the things like you did before. But now there are only three things to build. So there are the dwellings, the little houses, the trading posts, and the castle, right? There are two castles, but because there are no more priests, because there are no more tracks, you don't need any more priests. Because there are no more priests, you don't have temples and universities anymore, right? So that's all gone. You just have two castles that you can upgrade from a trading post, and they each unlock a different ability, right? You know, one of them is still like the castle, the main kind of like, you know, here's your faction's benefit. And the other one is kind of like a little nifty thing. So for example, mine directly replaced the university. So I was playing the leprechauns, which looked really cursed on the artwork. So I posted a picture of them on Instagram, and someone said, thanks, I won't be sleeping now. And so, yeah, like mine directly replaced the university's benefit, which is like you don't need 7 power to found a city, just 6 now. But like different factions have different like little benefits. So there is that, right? And that's kind of it. That's where the streamlining ends. There is one more thing. The power balls are much smaller, and they still work like the power balls, but there's no like sacrificing of power to push power along. So like there's just less power floating about, but it's just the same number of power always circulating back and forth.
On that note, you don't lose any victory points to get power from when someone builds next to you.
Yes. And like that's a pretty also kind of like streamline change, because you're not asking people to make really complex math decisions. Is this worth it? Is it not? You know, it feels more welcoming and it feels more streamlined, and that's kind of good. But there are like these moments that it generates now where the game has to be so incredibly precise, and you have to be also very incredibly precise in the game. In Terra Mystica, you always had, like, if you ran into problems, right, if you miscalculated, if you did something like poorly, you know, maybe there's somewhere I can pivot. Maybe there's this little like, oh, well, maybe I'll, you know, focus on not the map. I can't build what I wanted to. Like, I'll go up on the tracks or something like that, you know, or oh, I'll sacrifice some power, you know, or like do all these things. But there is nothing you can do in Terra Nova if you've miscalculated. You simply have miscalculated. And then the punishment of that is that you cannot do what you want to do because you made a mistake. And so, strangely, by cutting out all these rules that add complexity and cutting out all these rules that kind of make it a less welcome experience to someone who isn't used to complexity, it retains a very sharp edge that makes you feel like, oh no, okay, I have to be extremely precise in maths because all there is left is math. There's one resource. It says exactly how much things cost. There is not much you can do to leverage things. There are still these power actions on the board, right, which is that kind of like, oh, I can do this round and that maybe saves me, right? But then again, you have to be extremely precise because these points are still contested by all players, and now they're contested way more because that's the only point of leverage that everyone has. So if you miscalculated on money and there is only one thing that gives you money, extra money, in this round, and let's say you're playing with 4 players, only one person is going to get that.
I think, the timing needs to be more precise.
Yeah, than right. It does.
But I think the highs are higher and the lows are lower in Terra Mystica or Age of Innovation or whatever. Because, you know, sometimes I understand your point about it having to be very precise because maybe you can't do anything, but I've felt that in Age of Innovation,
oh,
and
sure.
Terra Mystica,
yeah.
and Gaia Project, and you've watched someone else have a good turn and they've done this and this and this and this, and then it comes to your turn and you messed up last turn or maybe three turns previously, and you've ended up in a position where you can't do a lot, and it changes the game for you at that point. That at that point you go, ah, I don't think I can pull this back now. And I didn't feel that in Terra Nova as much. But I think it is, you're right, it's a much more welcoming game. And I think it's a bit like, you know, have you seen those people that are really, really good at adding up maths? Like, you know, you can say to them 9, 7, 14, 25.
And are they on display somewhere? Like, where am I supposed to have seen them?
Like, you know, videos on the internet. You have the internet, right?
Right, okay, I see.
Like,
yeah.
You know, videos on the internet. Like, I can't do that, but I can add up, right? But they can do it in a much more efficient way. And that's kind of, but I don't have a broad knowledge of maths. I can't do calculus or, you know, Euclides or whatever, you know, I don't
Euclides.
Know, like geometry and,
right,
you know,
I
this
see.
And that and the other. And I don't have a, but I can do maths. And that's kind of how I felt with Terra Nova, was that you could get much better at it, but you could only get better at it within a framework.
Mm.
Whereas with Terra Mystica or Age of Innovation, there are so many branching paths and avenues and things that it's much harder to keep track. You see what I did there?
Uh-huh.
See, now I'm doing the puns.
Uh-huh.
It's much harder to keep track of all of that, which if you're a new player or an inexperienced player to Terra Mystica, it can be a bit overwhelming to have all of this going on at once. It's a lot of plate spinning, right?
Yeah.
And Terra Nova just says, no, you've got one plate, just do it as best you can. And your mate has one plate as well.
Mm-hmm.
They might have done it more than you. They might be more experienced at doing it than you, but you can do it as well as they can.
Yeah, I see where you're coming from. And here, okay, so here's my big positive for Terra Nova, right? If I taught someone Terra Nova, and then I had to teach them Terra Mystica, I would have to go, right, all of the things from that game, but also here's some more, right? Mm. It wouldn't have to be a full teach because the rules are identical. And even where they aren't, right? It's a very easy teach. So, you know, like, oh, you know how like you got power when someone built next to you? Well, it's like this now, but also like you can get more power, but you have to spend victory. Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. And it's definitely a jumping point, right?
I would love to teach someone Terra Nova and then teach them Terra Mystica and kind of, I just really want to see their faces when like I say things like that, when like, but you have to sacrifice victory points. Yeah. And they're like, whoa, right? Like, because it would feel like such a kind of step forward, I think, and an interesting step forward. So I think as a product, Terra Nova is like bang on for, I don't know, like a very niche audience. And I think the biggest audience for Terra Nova is people who already owned Terra Mystica and like Terra Mystica, but have friends who are not used to heavy Euro games and they want to teach them Terra Mystica, but don't feel confident enough to teach this heavy Euro game. So they would teach them Terra Nova, play maybe two or three games, and then go like, hey, next time we're going to play this advanced version. I think that's who this is for. I don't see another potential audience like, or again, if you wanted like to teach yourself Terra Mystica and you're not feeling confident enough, right? It's good. It's really good. I would recommend it for that.
Don't think the audience is as niche as that, because I love Terra Mystica. I love Age of Innovation. I love Gaia Project. I have been trying to get us to play Gaia Project for 2 months. I was like, I really want to play this game. Please, can we play Gaia Project again, right? But getting it to the table is tricky because we know it's going to be half a day, right? Setting it up, you know, relearning what
it's
we
bitty.
Have to learn, playing it, you know, blah, 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 blah. This, we got out because we already know how to play Terra Mystica.
I watched a 10-minute video, right?
You watched a 10-minute video. If we needed rules reference, we looked them up. But effectively, we got it out, played it, put it back on the shelf within, I don't know, an hour and a half.
Yeah.
2 hours max.
No, it wasn't 2 hours at all. It was quick.
An hour and a half, yeah. I think the game didn't take that long. And with setup and everything.
Yeah, with setup and teach, because the teach was also really quick. It was like, hey, you played Terra Mystica, here's what's different, right?
So I loved it for that reason, because I want to play these games. I just find them difficult to get to the table sometimes because they are big. And even at two, I thought this was pretty good.
Yeah, it was pretty good.
I would love to play it at a higher player count, but at two it was fine.
Mm. Overall, like, I don't know. I still think it's niche. It is aimed at, like you said, two specific groups. Mm. People who like Terra Mystica but don't have time for Terra Mystica. Which is, you know, like, you can play a worse version, and I don't want, it's not worse. It's just not like worse. It's just, you know, I don't think
you're comparing it. You're not seeing it as a standalone game. You're seeing it as a comparison to.
But it is it works in relation to Terra Mystica, right? Sure. Like, and I think it is either an onboarding game or a shortened game. But as a shortened game, as a person who loves Terra Mystica, I didn't get the. You know, the nitty gritty that I like in it,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
so you know, and also, like, as an onboarding game, I recognize its potential, right? It looks great for that, but mm-hmm. like, I just don't have anyone in my life right now.
I like the artwork in it too. I think that's engaging.
Yeah, I mean, it looked like, you know, mobile phone game artwork. Like,
wow,
it did. Like, it didn't inspire anything. It's cleaner. It's much cleaner than Terra Mystica in terms of artwork, right? But like, it didn't. That Cursed Leprechaun was like, I don't know. Like, it wasn't. I wasn't in love with it.
You know, there's another game called Terra Nova. I'm surprised they could call it Terra Nova, because there is already a game called Terra Nova, which is nothing like this.
Mm.
It's about building fences.
Oh wow, okay.
So,
well, if you think about it, terraforming is a kind of a fence.
What?
You know, it's like it's not habitable land for someone anymore, so they can't go there. That is a kind of a fence.
Right, okay.
Terra Nova. It was all right.
And that is all the games for this episode. Efka, why don't you tell us what is on the bonus episode and how can people find it?
Oh, well, that's such a good bonus episode this time. We have Harmonies, which is, I suspect, going to be the big summer hit of a board game, right? So tune in for that. And we're also going to be talking about Nucleum, the big Euro game that's kind of like Brass, but also nothing like Brass. So if that piqued your interest, you can go to patreon.com/nopunincluded, which is the website where you give us a bit of money every month and support our ongoing work in independent board game reviewing, because none of these games are review copies. We get everything ourselves. We don't liaise with publishers. We just get games, review them, and then deliver our verdict to you via this podcast and our YouTube channel, No Pun Included. So if you want to support that, patreon.com/nopunincluded, and you will get bonus episodes of this podcast. Every time an episode comes out on the main feed, we have a bonus episode, and if you support us, you'll get like all of those. You can just, you know, go in, listen to all of them, leave after a month if you can't afford to support us for a lot. Like, you know, £4 buys you into all the bonus episodes. So if you want that, that's there.
Finally, what is your game of the episode?
Terra Nova. Now that we've cut down the amount of games we're covering, this segment feels very weird.
Yeah.
Terra Nova is our game of the episode. Thank you so much for listening. And with that, why don't you say goodbye, Elaine?
Goodbye, Elaine.
Goodbye, Elaine.